this week's program, ahead of a recital at the Kimmel Center on Tuesday, we speak with the violinist Midori. Susan Lewis explores John Moran's award-winning play Old Wicked Songs as Bristol Riverside Theatre readies a new production directed by the playwright. Tom Keels explores the history of Tinley Temple in Philadelphia and its current renaissance. And we speak with Katie Friedland and Marla Shoemaker, the authors of a new children's book, Art Museum Opposites. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Born in Japan in 1971, violinist Goto Midori, or simply Midori as she is now better known, gave her first public performance in her native Osaka at age 6. When she was 11, she made her debut with the New York Philharmonic. In 1986, she made the front page of the New York Times after a performance at Tanglewood with Leonard Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic, when strings broke on first one, then a second violin. The Times headline read, "Girl 14 conquers Tanglewood with three violins." Now in her late 30s, Midori's early gifts for presenting uniquely emotional interpretations continue to evolve. She still maintains a busy concert schedule, but also focuses significant energy on education and outreach. Most artists are in some way or other involved with education. You have got, I think I counted, 5 different programs that you're administering and that you're running yourself. What's driving that?
I think my community work, that's what I like to call these activities that I do through Midori and Friends or Partners in Performance or Music Sharing, Youth Orchestra, whatever they are, I call them in a group as a community work. And I think they are really, for me, the core of my activities as a musician.
More important than the performances?
Well, I think that the community work is a performance and takes a lot of preparation, takes a lot of dedication, discipline, practice, rehearsal, everything that one does in preparing a particular piece of music for a concert, one also has to do for a community work.
How does the community work then feed back into the concert, the solo work, the recitals? How does the community work then feed back into standing in front of the Philadelphia Orchestra to perform a concerto?
For me, it's all a seamless performance that I do in front of the public, playing with youth orchestras or playing in juvenile correctional centers or hospitals or in schools. They're all so important to me and so meaningful, and the experiences that I get just as a whole living this kind of life is really truly something that I'm grateful for.
How is life on the road now, this long into a career? But presumably you have your routines, you have ways of living and ways of making yourself comfortable. But it can still be difficult.
I think the basic rule is that I'm on the road as little as possible. I make my dressing room into my home, and I don't like to particularly move around so much. So, you know, I come in the morning, have a rehearsal, and I just basically stay all day in the dressing room through after the concert.
Are you ever surprised by what you bring to a work that perhaps you thought you were familiar with, or something that you played often before? As you go older, do you ever feel surprised by the fact that these intricate emotions are now playing themselves out in your music?
I enjoy every experience of performing so much that I don't try to objectify, you know, what really happens afterwards. In fact, I think that one of the beauties of music is that there are so many diverse emotions that we as humans can have and experience and possess. And while objectively speaking, we may name such one emotion not so nice or painful or beautiful, you know, whatever it is, music has a capacity to make it into a very aesthetic experience. And so it's not really the type of emotion so much, whether it's a happy emotion or sad emotion or an ugly one or, you know, a painful one, but everything aesthetically becomes music in a very special way. So it's not that you get depressed or you get elated or anything like that, but you go through an emotional experience as a chunk.
And is that as authentic as the real thing? Is that emotional experience as real as an emotional experience that's brought about by life?
Anything that you experience in music, and particularly so the emotional experience, you have that experience because it's something that strikes a chord in your own past history.
That said, do you think then as you grow older and as you experience more of life that you gain a greater capacity for emoting through your music?
I think that the emotions get more intricate as we get older and as we experience more in life.
Does that make for better music making?
Makes it more interesting. It makes it the more intricate it is, the larger the sphere of your connectedness with different people and their emotions.
The violinist Midori. She performs a Philadelphia Chamber Music Society recital at the Kimmel Center's Prominent Theater on Tuesday, with piano accompaniment by Robert MacDonald. The program includes works by Mozart, Bartok, Bach, Crumb, and Szymanowski.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
John Maron's award-winning play, Old Wicked Songs, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in 1996 and has been performed around the world since. A drama set in 1980s Vienna, it tells the story of the relationship between two very different musicians who discover secrets about one another and learn about themselves through their work on a song cycle by the 19th century German composer Robert Schumann. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores a new staging of the work at Bristol Riverside Theatre, directed by the playwright.
One story is that told by Schumann's Dichterliebe, a song cycle set to the poetry of Heinrich Heine. The music starts the play, ends the play, and is woven throughout.
It's the story of a man who falls in love and then loses his love and how he deals with grief and how he moves on or doesn't move on.
Playwright John Marins originally had only four pieces from the song cycle in the work. But then a friend, actor David Hyde Pierce, also known as Dr. Niles Crane from the TV series Frasier, did a first reading.
David was a classical pianist originally at Yale before he decided to switch to acting. And so when he read the play out loud, he went over and played all the music. And as he did, I suddenly realized that it was the music that was elevating the play to another level.
Playwright John Marins has set against this music another tale of two men. One, a famous young American pianist who has burned out at the tender age of 25.
And he goes and he studies in Vienna with this very difficult, eccentric music professor who he's hoping is going to give him the gift of music back.
The relationship between the two men, however, is rocky from the beginning, complicated by misunderstandings. Young Stephen Hoffman, played in this production by David Kenner, comes to Vienna to study piano with the head of the university music department, Professor Schiller. Instead, he finds himself face-to-face with Professor Joseph Moshkan, played by Keith Baker, who intends to give him lessons of a different sort.
So, Grüß Gott, Stephen Hoffman.
Grüß Gott, Professor Schiller.
Oh, nein, Professor Moshkan.
What?
To study piano accompaniment with Herr Schiller, you must first study singing with me for 3 months to understand how the singer feels. These are Professor Schiller's instructions. He must have told you.
He said something about me learning to be respectful of singers, but I was certain I had talked him out of it. When he told me to report to room 315, I assumed it was his studio. I'm not a singer. I play the piano.
Actor David Kenner says Stephen is searching for identity.
He grew up as a prodigy playing the piano. He had everything. He had the spotlight. He had his name in lights. He did concerts around the world, and he's famous. And then he kind of loses it. He can't find his way anymore. He doesn't know why he's doing what he's doing, but he also doesn't know how to not be that person anymore.
Professor Moshkan also has lost his way, falling prey to drinking and darker moments. He's lost his teaching position, and now, says actor Keith Baker, he sees a chance to get it back.
He wants to teach well. Music is what gives him life. He wants an opportunity to show what he can do. He's been given that, and he's determined to prove himself.
But it's not going to be easy.
From the top.
Im Wun.
Vun.
Vun.
Lighter. Rounder. Vun.
Vun.
Again.
Vun, 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 Vun.
Wunderschönen.
Im Vun.
As the lessons progress and the days go by, music becomes the vehicle for the two men to relate.
See how the music sounds like someone thinking back, slowly remembering the month of May. As the singer comes in, the tonality lightens, but the first note still recalls the sad opening.
Im wunderschönen Monat Mai.
Sing along. Also, still hesitant. The music is central to the uncovering, the revealing of their separate secrets and lives and anguishes and hurts and pains. The music is what evokes all of that.
When they're not making music, and sometimes in the midst of it, they banter. With often humorous dialogue, the two men debate everything from politics to posture, from architecture to art, and whether sexual prowess has any relationship to the way one plays the piano. Actor David Kenner says the humor comes from the push and pull of the relationship, as it often does in life.
The comedy comes out of the way that they talk to each other and things about the music, and I think that's what we all do. Even when you're in the toughest times, it's the joy and the sadness at the same time. You know, that's another theme of the show, is both exist at the same time.
The events of 1980s Vienna, including the election of Kurt Waldheim as president of Austria, provides political context, and Jewish identity and anti-Semitism are other undercurrents in the unfolding story. After a study break, during which he visits Munich as well as a concentration camp, Stephen comes back to the professor, disillusioned and angry. As they return to work on Schumann's song, Ich grohle nicht, he refuses to sing in German, but does find the song's emotion.
Love is forever lost. I hate you not. I hate you not.
The music, says playwright John Marens, transcends human differences.
Music has this strange power, sometimes beyond the words, where you can reach people in a certain way that you can't through text or dialogue. And certainly in this play, which is about two musicians, they speak a very special language. They can't connect in so many basic ways, but music is that language where suddenly people can connect from all around the world.
John Marens chose the opening lines of the 16th song of the cycle as the title of the play. Translated, the old wicked songs, the dreams wicked and grim, let us bury them. Wicked songs are the preconceived notions that hold us back, says Marens, from being the best we can be. Through life's experiences of joy and sadness, we need to ditch those wicked songs to discover who we are, what we stand for, and what we can become.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Old Wicked Songs opens at the Bristol Riverside Theatre on Thursday and runs through December 5th.
We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe. We shall overcome.
The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. used the words "we shall overcome" often in sermons and in now historic orations, such as his "I Have a Dream" speech and in his remarks accepting the Nobel Prize for Peace in 1964. But the phrase, which became a clarion call for the civil rights movement of the 1960s, originated decades earlier in the lyrics of a gospel song by a Methodist preacher named Charles Tindley, who led a large African-American congregation in Philadelphia. The temple Tindley built on South Broad Street remains one of the city's beautiful and historic houses of worship, but its maintenance, like that of many other similar structures, creates a significant financial burden for its congregation. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores how the Tindley Temple United Methodist Church is adapting to the 21st century.
Near the entrance of Eden Cemetery in Delaware County, an imposing black monolith marks the grave of the Reverend Charles Albert Tindley, who lived from 1851 to 1933. Tindley, an African-American Methodist minister known as the Prince of Preachers, has also been called the father of gospel music. Among his more than 60 hymns are such standards as Stand By Me, Beams of Heaven As I Go, and I'll Overcome Someday, which was adapted as We Shall Overcome. Charles Albert Tindley was born a slave in Berlin, Maryland, in 1851. After the Civil War, he and his wife moved to Philadelphia. While working as a janitor at the Bainbridge Street Methodist Church, Tindley attended night school where he learned Latin and Hebrew. In 1902, Tindley returned to the Bainbridge Street Church, this time as its ordained minister. Under Tindley's leadership, says historian Shirley Turpin Parham, the church flourished.
Because of his charisma as a preacher and also because of his charisma as a musician, he had a beautiful singing voice. And not only would he preach, but he would sing while he was preaching. And most of the songs he wrote were songs to help people understand that what's going on with you is not your problem. You take it to the Lord and leave it there.
Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there.
Tindley's music touched a chord with Philadelphia's struggling African-American community. By the 1920s, his church had grown from 130 to several thousand members. To shelter his flock, Tindley decided to build a massive new sanctuary on South Broad Street between Fitzwater and Catherine. Shirley Turpin Parham believes that the church broke new ground, both literally and figuratively.
This was the first African-American church on Broad Street. And I marvel at how Tindley got to put a church of this size on Broad Street when you were dealing with the political powers that be.
In 1924, a large concrete and brick structure rose on Broad Street in a mixture of Art Deco and Romanesque styles. Tindley called his church God's Cathedral and insisted that it have a dozen doors, just like the 12-gated city in the Book of Revelations. The massive two-tiered sanctuary held 3,200 worshipers. Architectural historian Emily Cooperman is struck by the theatrical nature of Tindley's church.
On the south wall of the main worship space, the sanctuary, is an enormous Mueller organ, which dominates this incredible huge wall. At the front of the space, below the organ, there are a series of folding panels which open to reveal the baptismal pool. It is an extraordinary feature that I've never seen in any other church building, that clearly made a kind of religious theater.
In 1927, the church was renamed the Tindley Temple Methodist Church in honor of its minister. By then, it had over 10,000 members and was the largest Methodist congregation in America. Tindley died in 1933 in the depths of the Depression. Money was so scarce that his grave remained unmarked until the current monument was erected in 2002. Struggling to pay its enormous construction debts, Tindley's temple barely survived. Today, the Tindley Temple appears much as it did when Charles A. Tindley was minister, but it faces new challenges. Membership has dropped to under 200 people. Gentrification has transformed the surrounding neighborhood, once the center of African-American life in Philadelphia. Across Broad Street from the church, a new luxury apartment building rents one-bedroom units from $2,000 a month. Elaine Ayers is the current minister.
Today, most of our congregation comes from outside. And so consequently, when we get here, the problems are like, wow, we're in a second hand. We're not there to see what actually the problem is. But the problems are still the same. Oh, yeah, you can't afford $1 million house down here. That's what I just saw up here. I can't afford it.
Tindley's shrinking congregation must now shoulder the spiraling cost of its gigantic temple, says architectural historian Emily Cooperman.
Maintaining a historic church is a costly and complicated business. They often have many maintenance issues that private residences do not, and they are almost always complicated physical plants that have multiple material issues to wrestle with. The maintenance and preservation of these buildings is a challenge for every congregation.
To meet this challenge, the Tindley Temple has joined forces with two nonprofit organizations, Partners for Sacred Spaces and the Preservation Alliance of Greater Philadelphia. In association with the Preservation Alliance, Emily Cooperman has worked with the church to apply for listing on the National Register of Historic Places. Meanwhile, Elaine Ayers is working to emphasize her church's community-based services, like its soup kitchen founded by Tindley himself during the Depression, and its partnerships with local schools.
Tindley is an integral part of this community itself. And if something would happen, then there would be an empty space in which Tindley fills now, not only spiritual, but also helping those who are the last of the lost and those who are in need.
Ayers is also working with Partners for Sacred Places to explore use of the temple as a performance and rehearsal site for arts groups. As the Tindley Temple navigates its course under difficult conditions, it may help other cash-strapped congregations discover how to turn their architectural albatrosses into cultural and financial assets.
WRTI's Tom Keels. The Tindley Temple's Christmas concert of Handel's Messiah will take place at the church at 750 South Broad Street on Sunday, December 5th at 3:30. The second book from two Philadelphia Museum of Art educators is out now on Temple University Press. Art Museum Opposites by Katie Friedland, the museum's manager of family and children's programs, and Marla Shoemaker, the senior curator of education, follows the success of 2008's A is for Art Museum. The aim of Art Museum Opposites is to help 4 to 8-year-old children learn the difference between such concepts as little and lots, big and small, and old and new, using paintings, sculptures, and other objects from the museum's collections. I spoke with Katie Friedland and Marla Shoemaker earlier this week.
So the first book was an easy alphabet-based project. How did either or both of you decide that this one would take a turn to the left or the right and be about opposites? Marla?
We both very much wanted to do a book that was a little more complex and ask of people to look at two objects together. And that comes from a lot of different things. Kids, one of the very first skills kids learn is compare and contrast. It's how they learn their colors. They learn this is red because it doesn't look like this one, and this one is blue. So it's a very, very early skill that you use your whole life in very subtle ways, but that starts very early. And secondly, because I'm trained in art history is always taught with two slides on the screen at one time. And there's a reason for that, because it's easier to talk about it. Somehow it's easier to say, well, see how these lines are thinner than these lines over here, because thin is a relative term.
Right.
So thin could mean Katie, who's nice and slender, or could meet a tiny little line, you know. So looking at two things together is what we do a lot here at the museum.
So you're getting to these kids young in the hope of turning them into art historians. I know what you're doing.
It can be a really rich conversation, and it can go a lot of places. And it brings, in our own teaching of children here, which both Katie and I do in the galleries, kids are just really good at it. They're really good at comparing and contrasting, and the longer you look, the more things you notice. So we knew we wanted to work with two images on a spread. And that's really the concept of the book. And when it came to trying to organize it into something of a relatively modest scale that parents and children could wrap their minds around, we looked at similar things, and we came up with this idea of using opposite words, since that's another kind of book young kids look at, where they learn big and small, short and tall, and I think it's safe to say no two works of art in the world are ever completely opposite from one another. They're too complex to be opposites. But the words are opposites. So you can have a little and a lot, which are opposite concepts, and you illustrate them with works of art.
Let me turn to you, Katie. So you then began walking through the galleries, as you do here regularly in the course of your job, and immediately seeing things as opposites, or how did you both go about deciding what opposites would be in the book?
It was a really fun, Marla and I called it our card game that we were playing in our office. We also got to sort of almost experiment as curators, because we work in education, but to pull up two works of art that might be on opposite sides of the building, but we would print them out and look at them in our office and say, oh my God, look how amazing they look together. Look how they illustrate something together. It was exciting. So there was definitely a lot of walking. I mean, it's a huge collection, and not everything is on view. So it was a lot of searches, you know, big web searches on our computers. That it was just really fun.
How many of the objects that are in the book can be seen by young visitors to the museum?
I would would say about half, probably. I would say about half of the images are available to be seen. But the great thing about the museum, and one of the wonderful things why people should come back so often, is that the objects in the galleries are often changing. So just because an image is on view doesn't mean that it will be on view forever, and something else might rotate onto view. So some of the objects in the empty and full, the big pot of mussels was something that was on view a few years ago that I remember teaching with and I remember kids loving, but it's not on view now.
So, Marla, then, when you were looking at the objects, how complex or simple did they need to be for the audience they were intended for?
We really believe that kids are capable of looking at complex images, and we spend the bulk of the money on the book in creating beautiful, beautiful, super high-quality photographs of images. We're really invested in that. So these works of art look great in the book. Of course, they look even greater when you see them in person, but they're quite spectacular.
When you were thinking of the concept for the book, the Amesfer Museum, clearly there needed to be a little bit of literacy. Of course, parents could explain to the children what they were seeing. With this, none is required. The kids can look at the image and get it without reading, even needing to know what the words they're looking for are. Was that central to your idea?
I think we wanted something that could come across really clearly. As I have a almost 4-year-old, and I know you have a child around the same age, he likes to look at books himself and, you know, talk to himself. But we also really wanted to make sure that this was still something that parents could interact with their children. So there's extra text in each pairing that gives some deeper looking questions and for parents to have the opportunity to talk a little more in depth about each work of art if they want to. But also we wanted something that you could just look at that sun and moon and know that it was day and night and there's no way around, you know, it's clear.
A reaction I had, Marla, with my own 4-year-old from the other book was that she would see an image in the book and then when she came to the museum and saw it, it was almost like meeting a famous person for her. Was that something you had in mind?
Yes, it's absolutely true that when you see something in a book or digitally on the web, when you see the real thing, it's like, that's the one that we saw. That's the one Daddy and I sat and looked at, you know. That's actually a well-known feature. When you watch Baryshnikov dance on TV and then you see the real Baryshnikov, it's like, that's really him. There's a sort of a perceptual confirmation of things that you know. My mother is not an art historian, but she can recognize a work by Van Gogh, for example. And she gets tremendous satisfaction when she sees from a distance, I know that work is by Vincent van Gogh. So there's this sort of recognition and acknowledgement of something that you saw before, and then you get to see the real thing. That's pretty powerful. And even little kids get it. They're like, that's the one! You know, they really like it.
In the overall philosophy of art education at the museum, is it about creating art aficionados who will become future visitors? And if so, how do these books feed into that, do you think?
Well, I do think not in a holistic approach. We are definitely trying to, you know, our goal is to promote the museum and to help families not necessarily come to our museum, but to become more visually literate and to have a larger interest in works of art as a whole, because we really think that works of art are important and can enrich your life. So I hope that people come more often. We do know that through studies that if you come with your family to a museum as a child, you're more likely to come back as an adult. So we know that that's true, and I hope that people visit. But more, I think Marla and I both just wanted to share these works of art that we think are so beautiful and that we really enjoy looking at and wanted children to be able to enjoy them too.
Philadelphia Museum of Art educators Katie Friedland and Marla Shoemaker, authors of Art Museum Opposites, now available on the Temple Press imprint. As part of the launch of the book, the museum is hosting an Every Family Party this afternoon. Family-friendly activities with food, music, dancing and performances will take place from 5:30 to 8 at the museum's main building. The event is a fundraiser with proceeds benefiting the museum's Division of Education. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.